1590 WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk, presents Smart Girl Politics, hosted by Karen Testerman and Susan Olson. The show takes a look at the latest news and developments throughout the state of New Hampshire from a conservative women's viewpoint. Whether it's social, economic, or financial topics, Smart Girl Politics will cover it all. Join the show, give us a piece of your mind, and voice your input by calling 816-0019. It's Smart Girl Politics, hosted by Karen Testerman and Susan Olson on 1590 WSMN, Nashua's News and Talk.
This is Karen Testerman with Smart Girl Politics, and in studio we have Smart Girl Nancy Elliott this morning. Nancy is a, she's become quite an international star, having started out as a state representative. Actually, she started out as a mother and a wife, and then she started to grow her wings and became a state representative, and now is an international speaker on euthanasia, and she's been planning a lot of good things. So welcome to the studio, Nancy.
Thank you, Karen. Thank you for having me. You make me sound really important.
Well, I think you are, and I think it's really kind of exciting to see how God uses people in the most unexpected ways, because I'm sure that was never on your dream sheet.
I never thought I'd do any of that.
No. It's like me. I know there's a lot of things that are not on my dream sheet, and I go, wow. How did I get here, and what, you know, you can turn around and you can see the path that led you there, but it was not anything that I sort of sat down with a pencil and paper and said, in 1993, I will be doing whatever. And so it's always exciting.
That's true.
Yeah, so where are you off to next? I mean, you're going...
I am going to Rome.
Oh, wow.
So I'm going to be meeting with some leaders there to discuss the problem of euthanasia across the world and hopefully get a plan to fight it.
Oh, great. Well, that is an area that we don't hear a lot about, but it seems to have crept in under the radar to a lot of our hospitals, and we don't even really realize that it's happening.
That's true. And it's not anything that's discussed for the most part in the public, but behind the scenes, you know, doctors, nurses, I'm sure are fairly aware of it.
Uh-huh. Well, it's interesting because I was up on the terrysfight.org where Terry Schiavo was basically starved and not given hydration. When was it? It's been several years back now. It seems like it was... you know, in some ways, it seemed like it was yesterday, but it was quite a time back. And because of court decisions, etc., her, even though she had family that wanted to care for her, etc., they allowed the husband to be able to make the final decisions, and he said withdraw the feeding tube and the water, and so she basically starved to death. And even though it's interesting that medical people will tell you all it doesn't hurt, there's no problem, it's very peaceful, it's very painful.
Yeah, just imagine, you know, you're dying and they're not giving you a drink. It happens a lot here, but the only time you hear about it is when somebody like Terry Schiavo's family makes an objection.
Right.
For the most part, it just... you know, happens. And they actually, in London, in England, they have a real problem with it. They have a thing called the Liverpool pathway, which if the doctor decides that it's your time to die, they put you on it. And in some cases, it would be very correct. You know, the person is dying. They're going to die in a couple hours. You don't want to feed them and make them sick. But there's other people that aren't imminently dying, and they stop feeding them, and the family will ask for food and water, and they'll say no. They're on this Liverpool pathway. And the people, a lot of the regular people, are starting to really complain about in the newspapers over there.
Right, and it actually happens here. It happened to my uncle.
It does.
Uncle's family was attending him and taking care of him and so forth, and he had Alzheimer's, and in Alzheimer's, eventually your brain forgets to how to tell your body to swallow and so forth like that. So, and he had reached that stage. He was still a cognizant. He still walked around and so forth, but he was having trouble keeping food down, so they were going to put a feeding tube in, and his wife came in and said no. She didn't want him to have water or food, and it was really sad because my cousin tells me that he called out at one time, and he said it hurts so much. Make it stop hurting.
Oh, that's so sad.
It is, and yet we don't want an animal to suffer like that, and yet we'll let human beings suffer like that. So, and you know, the thing is, you're aware of what goes on in Obamacare, and Sarah Palin took a lot of heat for calling attention to the fact that there were death panels there. But
well, they're there. You know, they may not be called death panels because that would be too, you know, noticeable, but they're making life and death decisions. Who deserves to die and who deserves to live?
And, you know, they couch it under a lot of different terms. What are some of those terms, Nancy?
I'm coming up blank on that right now, Karen.
I'm thinking, like, don't they call it death with dignity?
Oh, that, yes. Death with dignity. They call it aid in dying. Aid in dying, they're killing you.
And didn't they just defeat a bill down in Massachusetts that would have allowed for assisted suicide?
They did. And it was a ballot initiative, which usually plays very well because the public doesn't know all the ins and outs as far as how this can be used to abuse seniors, especially those who have money. It's another path to get at that money sooner. So if you don't really analyze it and you just go in and say, if I'm sick, should I be able to kill myself? Well, a lot of people would say, I wouldn't do it, but who am I to tell my neighbor? And they go and check, okay. And so it's really a very miracle that we were able to stop that. And there was a coalition that worked very hard to expose what this bill did.
And there were some other implications that because Boston and Massachusetts, in Massachusetts, is such a hub for medical treatment, there were some far-reaching tentacles that would have occurred because if they had passed that particular bill.
Well, this is true. Boston has the finest medical schools probably in the world. They train doctors for all over the country, all over the world. If they also have the New England Journal of Medicine, and if it became the standard of care to kill your patients in Massachusetts, that would spread. It would spread all over the country. And I had people on the world stage that were concerned that it would be the downfall of the entire world.
Wow. And we don't think about a little incremental step like that having such a massive effect of unintended consequences down the road.
A little ballot initiative, yeah. You know, who would think?
One of my readers also reminded me that we often forget, we keep talking about Obamacare, but we often forget that Hillary had her health care and that was sort of a forerunner to what we're experiencing today, and you know, I'm sure that there were other little incremental steps along the way that assisted us in getting our legislation all lined up within each of the states that would just allow this to be a little push to get it over the cliff.
Yeah, it's the same plan. And you know, talking about the euthanasia in connection. You cannot sustain the health care bill without taking health care away from those who are very sick, you know, and aren't deemed as having the higher quality of life.
And, you know, I wonder who determines if you have the higher quality of life? I mean, do you have to be absolutely perfect? Is this a Margaret Sanger move?
I would think that, yes, they are looking for perfection. We only need to look at Oregon to see how the government has used their assisted suicide bill. The state-run insurance company, you know, that would be like a Medicaid-type thing. Now, if the person has a disease and they're not expected to live longer than 5 years, they would not be getting treatment. So say you had cancer and your case would be 49% curable to live over 5 years. Well, you don't make the criteria, you know, because
you have to be more than 50%.
Well, I'm not sure what the percent is, but you've got to have the expectancy of living longer than 5 years.
Wow. And so all of these people who have been given a prognosis of maybe 6 months to a year and end up living for 5 to 10 years would fail that criteria.
They would be denied treatment. So anybody that you know who has outlived what the doctor told them wouldn't have gotten, you know, the treatment, you know?
Yeah, it's amazing to me how this seems to have crept in, and we often, I keep thinking back to, well, we often wonder why, what gives a child, I remember Gary Bauer spoke about this, he said, what gives a child the idea that she can take the baby that she's just delivered and throw it away like a styrofoam cup? And I often think that it's because we've become more cognizant and more pushing of death-type activities than we have of protecting life and making sure that that people exist. So,
well, we've also left any kind of self-sacrifice. You know, if it's going to be hard to care for your ailing husband or parent, let's get him out of the way.
Yeah. That's really something. Well, we have to take a short break. And this is Karen Testerman with Smart Girl Politics and Nancy Elliott, our Smart Girl expert on euthanasia. And we will be back after this. And we're back. This is Karen Testerman with Smart Girl Politics. Our co-host, Susan Olson, is AWOL, I'd like to say, but not really. We just want her to know that we miss her. And in studio, we have Nancy Elliott, one of our smart girls who is an expert on euthanasia. And on the line today, we have a very special guest, Greg Marad. Greg is the vice president of the National Right to Work Committee. And welcome to Smart Girl Politics, Greg.
Thanks, Karen. Glad to be with you.
I'm glad to have you with us. I'm sorry that Right to Work didn't pass in New Hampshire. It's sort of a bittersweet because if it had passed in New Hampshire and we'd been able to override the governor's veto, then we wouldn't be talking to you. So now we are talking to you. Tell us how are you progressing around the country as far as getting Right to Work legislation accomplished?
Well, passing it in Michigan last month was definitely a shot in the arm for a whole lot of places that might not have thought Right to Work was possible before and are now saying, well, if Michigan could do it, certainly we could do it here too. And we've seen a real surge in enthusiasm on this issue across the Midwest and a few other places that don't have Right to Work laws now. Unfortunately, things didn't go so well last November in New Hampshire, and we're probably not in a position to pass it there this cycle. But we haven't given up on the Granite State, and we'll be back again as things move forward.
Well, I hope so. And there's been a lot of myth surrounding Right to Work and what it does. And so, can you give us a good synopsis on just exactly what the legislation would accomplish?
Sure. It's really a very simple concept. It simply says nobody can be forced as a condition of employment to join a union or pay any dues or fees to a union. And it's as simple as that. It means people can choose for themselves whether or not they think the union in their workplace deserves their support.
So if you were a state worker, you wouldn't have to sign that little thing, that little piece of paper that says, I will join the union?
Exactly.
As a condition of my employment?
Exactly. And technically, they're not becoming members, but they are agreeing to pay a significant portion, sometimes as much as full dues, for this so-called representation that the union supposedly provides to them, representation that they don't want, many of them, did not ask for, would give up if they could, and often works against their interests.
How come it isn't an opt-in option? You know, that I would think that that would be a more fair approach to unions in the first place.
Absolutely. It ought to be up to the individual's choice whether or not they want to be part of a union. I mean, freedom of association, as with all the freedoms, implies the freedom not to associate. We don't have that in this country, at least not in New Hampshire, and not in the non-right-to-work states, because the unions, through a raw exercise of political power, have grabbed the ability to force people to pay them whether people think they're being served well or not.
You know, the thing is, this is Nancy Elliott, by the way. The thing is, this actually hurts people in their jobs, because the union can sometimes make it so expensive that they just don't have that position anymore. They just, you know, scale down. I know a lot of companies that were union, and they've just scaled back to a skeleton force because of the squeezing.
That can certainly happen. I mean, I'm not here to say that all unions are universally bad, or that they're always bad actors, or even that they're always bad for their companies. But it ought to be up to the individual to choose to decide whether or not he's being well served by the union in his workplace.
Well, what are some of the benefits that unions actually have served the people over history?
Well, when you see an employer who is a bad actor, who is not treating his people well or fairly, it is very valuable for those people to be able to gather together and say, we're going to negotiate in concert. We are going to deal with the employer as a united group instead of letting him pick us off one by one. And certainly the ability of people to bargain collectively has been a benefit in many cases. The problem isn't collective bargaining. The problem is when it becomes monopoly bargaining, when the union says, we're going to bargain on behalf of everybody here, whether they like it or not.
Right, right. I agree that is an interest. You know, I can see where there have been situations where we've had some, as you say, bad players in the employer a role, in the leading role, but also what seems to have happened is that those bad players have now sprouted up within the collective bargaining agents, and so we now have those people who are power hungry and seem to want to lord it over other people that we are going to show you how to get it.
Sure, and they've been there really at least as far back as 1935 when they gained the monopoly power to begin with.
Uh-huh.
There have been bad actors on both sides for a very long time.
Yeah.
You know, I meet with people across this country on a regular basis, business owners and union members and union non-members alike, and you know, all of them pretty much agree a business gets the union it deserves. And businessmen understand this. If you treat your people well, you treat them fairly, and you pay them a decent wage for the place where they live, they don't put a union in between you and them. And when you treat your people poorly, you're likely to end up with a confrontational union that you're going to be unhappy with.
Right. So now, you say that you don't think it's going to go anywhere in New Hampshire, at least under this current administration. What could we be doing, and what can the people who are listening to this program be doing to reinforce the forces that would like to get this accomplished at some time in the future? Is there anything? Are we sort of just sort of waiting in the and hoping not to drown here in New Hampshire? Are we going to have? Is there any hope out there?
Well, the hope for change is often at the ballot box, though we believe very much in aggressively lobbying all the existing politicians. And I am confident that the path to victory is a program that convinces every politician in the state that right to work is a popular issue, that the people want it. And when you get that, you end up with politicians either changing their minds or getting replaced.
So is it really a partisan type of legislation, or are there people on both sides of the aisle that support right to work?
Well, it's getting hard to find many Democrats that support right to work. The Democrat Party is pretty tightly tied in with the big labor movement. Unions give the Democrat Party a great deal of money and provide a great deal of the foot soldier support for Democrat campaigns. And so a Democrat with the courage to support right to work usually finds himself on the receiving end of big labor's gunfire during the primary phase. And it's not to say there are none, but there aren't very many. On the Republican side, you tend to find more support for right to work. Even there, you find some Republicans who are just deathly afraid of big labor and would rather see this issue not come up. And they are often we have to do some work to convince them that this is an issue that helps them politically, not hurts them politically.
So where are you going next after Michigan? Because you don't have the whole of the United States yet.
No, we're almost to the halfway point. We're at 24 now with Michigan. Mm-hmm. The next states that we're looking at, Kentucky is real high on the list. Montana is really high on the list, though the governor there would probably veto it. We're going to come at him anyway. Missouri is high on the list. Would like to see it happen in Wisconsin. The governor there has said he's not really interested in it for the remainder of this term, but that doesn't mean that he wouldn't sign it if we got it to him. It's on the table in Pennsylvania. I think it's being introduced in the next couple of days there. Colorado is always a possibility. There's a lot of places where we're looking at 2 to 4 year programs rather than this year. Most likely we will not pass any new right to work laws this year, but 2012 was really an aberration. We passed two in 2012. The last time we'd achieved that was all the way back to 1952. And the previous one before 2012 was Oklahoma in 2001. So right to work laws are usually a long, hard fight, and we expect that we're in the middle phases of that long, hard fight in two or three places and at the beginning of that long, hard fight in five or six more.
Okay, so now when did this right to work move start?
Well, 1947, Congress passed the Taft-Hartley Act, which gave states the freedom to pass right to work laws. When they passed the Wagner Act in 1935, they created this structure of monopoly bargaining and letting unions force people to pay. In 47, they realized they'd gone too far, and they rolled it back a little bit with Section 14B of Taft-Hartley. That's when we started seeing right-to-work laws pass.
Okay.
The bulk of them were passed in the late 40s and 50s.
So if our listeners want to know any more about right-to-work or what it means or what you're doing or how they can get involved, where do they go?
www.nrtwc, that's National Right to Work Committee.org.
Okay. And you also have a foundation. What does that do?
We do. The Right to Work Legal Defense Foundation, its mission is to provide free legal aid to people who have been badly served or abused by their unions. People who want to opt out of paying for union politics, people in right to work states who are nevertheless fired for refusal to pay union dues, things like that. Sometimes unions and employers will collude together and cut a sweetheart deal to force everybody to pay union dues and lower their wages. In such cases, we'll sue both the union and the employer.
Okay. Have you had some recent victories there?
Yeah, the Right to Work Foundation has had a number of